I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio.
Hi, I was just noticing across the room. That's a really nice, pretty dress. Well, I saw you smiling. I've never seen you before. I was wondering, you know, if you'd like, you know... Oh, no? Okay, well... never mind. See you later. Hey, you new wave! Come over here. You're the prettiest thing I've seen all year. Hey, you new wave! Don't turn away. Those pouty lips. And listen to what I say.
Why?
So smoke that.
Welcome to Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton. And about an hour from now, well, a little more than an hour from now, we'll be talking with Eric Margolis from the Toronto Star Sun, one of those, the Sun, I think, right? Yeah, Sun National Media in Canada. You know, Eric Margolis, man, the great Canadian anti-war guy. I got a bunch of angry emails from angry Canadians lately saying, hey, don't you know there's a lot of good anti-war guys up here in Canada besides Eric Margolis? Yeah, actually, I think I did. Don't we run Canadians sometimes at antiwar.com? Anyway, I don't know. Yeah. Send us articles by Canadians. If they're good, we'll run them. But, you know, we can only read about 50,000 different sources a day. Any more than that, it's pretty much breaking the back of our abilities, you know? Anyway, let's start the show with Ross' story. Well, actually, I should start with the phone number. Hey, there's a phone number. It's 512-6... nope, that isn't it. Yeah, it is it. 512-646-6446. 512-646-6446, if anybody wants to call in the show and take part. Okay, first story. It's pretty low on the top of the page at antiwar.com today. A link to the rawstory.com. Number of Americans who believe Saddam 9/11 tie rises to 41%. A new Newsweek poll out this weekend exposed gaps in America's knowledge of history and current events. Perhaps most alarmingly, 41% of Americans answered yes to the question, Do you think Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq was directly involved in planning, financing, or carrying out the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001? The total is actually up 5 points since September 2004. Further, a majority of people couldn't identify Saudi Arabia as the country of origin of most of the 9/11 hijackers, even given the question in multiple-choice format. 20%, that's one-fifth, answered Iraq, while 14% believe the hijackers came from Iran. A majority, 52%, believe the U.S. is losing the war on terror. Closer to home, 89% of Americans are unable to name the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. 89%, a bare majority, was able to name the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Although it was a 77% of the people responded that they didn't know and didn't care who won American Idol. So that's pretty good, right? 77%. I thought a lot more people cared about that crap. But yeah, just for the record, none of the hijackers came from Iraq. None of the hijackers came from Iran. All of the hijackers came from countries that are friendly to the United States. That is, their governments are puppet governments of our empire. Those are the people who attacked us on September 11th. 15 of them were from Saudi Arabia. The rest were Egyptian and Yemeni, etc. Which, that's the Arabian Peninsula, so it doesn't really count as separate. You know, Yemen. I don't think we have bases in Yemen, or did, but close enough. We had them near Mecca and Medina, and that's bad enough. And no, Iraq had absolutely nothing to do with it. And the only person who even claims that there's a credible link there at all, the only people, are the guys in Dick Cheney's office, Dick Cheney himself, his aides, and the liars at the Weekly Standard. Other than that, there's no evidence at all. And in fact, I interviewed on this show, and hang right there, caller, get right to you. I interviewed on this show Michael Scheuer, the former head of the Bin Laden unit. And after September 11th, when the Bush administration decided they were going to go to war and they needed an excuse, George Tenet ordered the CIA analysts to go back over everything they had and prove that there was a tie between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. And they went back and, in fact, proved the exact opposite of that. And Scheuer even says he's embarrassed because in his first book that he wrote for the CIA, From Open Source Material Through Our Enemy's Eyes, that in that book, he says there was a tie between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. But then when he really got the job of going through all the CIA's intelligence about that in the run-up to war, he determined that there was no truth to it at all. None. Zero zilch. The meeting in Prague between Mohammed Atta and Iraqi intelligence never took place. The whole thing's a lie. It always was a lie. And the fact that almost half, 41% of the American people think Saddam did 9/11. I understand the cognitive dissonance. I've met people before who said, well, if he didn't do it, then why'd we invade them then? Yeah, well, good question. But the fact that we invaded them doesn't mean that they did the attack after the fact, just to somehow justify it. And it's unforgivable that in this country 41% believe that Saddam was responsible for that attack. If that was true, why did they wait till March 2003 to invade and try to, you know, beg permission from France and Russia and everybody, and Colin Powell insist on going to the UN and make up all these lies about weapons of mass destruction? Why don't we just invade Iraq in November of 2001, the same time we invaded Afghanistan? Then, I mean, this also shows, I think, doesn't it, that 41% of the American people are just incapable of thinking, incapable of, you know, measuring these things against each other. If Iraq did it, then why'd we wait till March 2003 to invade? Huh? I mean, come on. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show.
Hello. How you doing, Scott?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. I just moved here to Austin a couple days ago and was standing through. I'm very glad I found your station.
Oh, cool. Well, thanks for listening.
I really appreciate the input. We don't have much like this out there, and it's good to hear. I don't really have much on the topic. I love what you're talking about. Got some good points. It's nice to hear free thinkers. after we're done with this quick, intro and thank you, and I'm glad to find your station, I'm also looking for work.
Well, I'm afraid to let you know, bro, but Chaos Radio ain't hiring.
No problem. I will keep listening, though.
Yeah, please do.
Excellent. Thanks a lot, Scott. Keep it up.
Yeah, hey, and check out KAOS959.com.
959.com?
That's right, the music we want to hear.
Excellent. Thanks, Scott.
All right, hey, thanks for calling in.
No problem.
Yes, I'm afraid, my friends, that Chaos Radio isn't really an employment opportunity. Chaos Radio is more like a place where people get together, drink beers, and play their record collection for their friends to hear. We're more like that. KAOS959.com, streaming live, worldwide, all over the damn place. Call in number 646-6446. 646-6446 if you're from out of town. 512-646-6446. And, yeah, I don't know. I guess I don't want to belabor this point about this poll too much. But, I think what this shows, and, you know, probably this is a little bit the fault of the 9/11 kooks, but it's mostly the fault of the government. The government in this country, they engage in such an immediate and massive cover-up after September 11th because, of course, they completely failed on their job. The same former CIA guy that I just referred to, Michael Scheuer, the former head of the Bin Laden unit, except for a short period of time before the attack, he said, I believe it was his exact words on this radio show, were they had the information they needed to stop it. And they didn't because, and this is the paraphrase, the rest of it, they didn't because of their, frankly, criminal negligence. Because they didn't give a shit to do their job. And they had to cover up that fact. And so the 9/11 Commission report and all that stuff, it's all a bunch of hooey. And the story, they just gave us the base narrative. And then they didn't really want to, you know, they wanted to avoid filling in the details as much as possible. Because the details are extremely embarrassing. You know, two of the Flight 77 hijackers living with an FBI informant in San Diego. The FBI agents investigating Moussaoui sending 70-something messages to headquarters. Remember that when it came out at Moussaoui's trial? 70-something messages saying, man, we think this guy's like a would-be suicide hijacker. We really, really want to search his computer, boss, please. And we're denied permission to even go to the FISA court to ask for a warrant. In an actual case that you would use FISA, you know, supposedly for. They use it for everything else except what it's actually for. So anyway, because of this massive cover-up, because of their criminal negligence, because Republicans and Democrats created the policy that provoked the attacks and also the policies that left us vulnerable to them, they engaged in a big everybody, join in covering each other's asses so that the American people don't hold any of us responsible was basically the way they went about it. And then they exploited the 9/11 attack and the fear that was caused by it in order to lie us into war in Iraq. And what they said in the run-up to war, and I remember arguing with people and telling them, now hold on a minute, not even George Bush says that Saddam Hussein was in on the 9/11 attack. He hasn't said that, and I've been paying attention to everything he said. This is in the run-up to war. He has not said that Iraq did it. You have to listen a little bit more carefully. And the guy said, no, I'm sure he did. Why would we be invading then? Yeah. Well, what he said was, we have to invade Iraq because of 9/11. Because we learned the lesson that you can't just wait around for people to attack you first. You have to attack them first. That's what they said. But it sure sounded like what they were saying was that Iraq did it. But they didn't say that. It's very deliberate propaganda. And so the issue is so confused. The American people don't know the first thing about what happened there that day, guys. They don't even know. Iraqis did it, huh? Iranians did it. Is that right? Is that perhaps because they're next on the list to be bombed? 41% in this particular random sample anyway. 41% think Saddam did it. All right, well, here's what happened, okay? Here's what happened. Arab Afghans, in the 1980s, there was a holy war against the Russians. A bunch of Arabs were sent there, because, Afghanistan ain't anywhere near Arab land. There's a whole Persian between them and everything. It's an entirely different ethnicity of people. Yes, they're Sunni Muslims. But anyway, they sent a bunch of Arabs to Afghanistan to fight the Russians, including Osama bin Laden and many others a lot like him. And America backed them, and they eventually were victorious in no small measure due to the shoulder-fired Stinger missiles, guided Stinger missiles, that took out the Russian attack helicopters. Remember in Red Dawn, those big gray helicopters that come over the hill and shoot Jennifer Grey in the chest? And Patrick Swayze, gives her a grenade and she does a suicide bombing against the foreign occupier. Remember that, huh? In Red Dawn? Anyway, those helicopters, ones a lot like them or whatever. I forgot what they were called. The Hind gunships or something. Is that what it was? These Russian attack helicopters were incredibly deadly to the Mujahideen. And so America gave them these Stinger missiles and, that was really a big part of how they won their victory. And, of course, they complained. What? What do you mean the Americans were backing us and giving us money and guns and using us against the Soviets? No way. It was us and Allah and our faith that defeated the superpower. That was the lesson they learned. And then Saddam, perhaps misinterpreting his instructions or perhaps just kind of going one bridge too far and thinking he could get away with it, invaded not just the northern oil fields of Kuwait, but took over that entire country. Bush and Baker didn't want to do anything about it until Margaret Thatcher, whose interest it was to see Kuwait, so-called sovereign, at least in terms of its relationship with Iraq. So they went in there and they decided that this will not stand. They went in there, they convinced the king of Saudi Arabia, really they didn't give him any choice, to let the American military occupy the Saudi desert in order to wage war against Iraq. And then after George Bush encouraged the Shia to rise up and overthrow Saddam Hussein, he betrayed them, let Saddam Hussein keep his attack helicopters and massacre all of them, and stay in power. It was a good 100,000 people massacred by Saddam Hussein there in 1991 after the war. His own people in the presence of Americans. After Bush, dropped leaflets everywhere telling the people to rise up. So anyway, Saddam was left in power, so now this quote-unquote necessitated that the American military stay in Saudi Arabia forever. Don't you remember back in 96, 97, there was all this hoorah about female soldiers in Saudi Arabia who were mad that they had to cover their heads and that they weren't allowed to drive and drink and whatever, and they were suing. Remember that? I remember they were talking about this I was driving a taxi cab listening to G. Gordon Liddy. It must have been 97, 98, something like that. And on the G. Gordon Liddy show, they were discussing this. They were suing. I don't remember if they were suing in some Saudi court or they were trying to sue in an American court, that their civil rights were being infringed because those darn Saudis won't let the women soldiers drive around and drink alcohol and what have you. Remember that? Okay, well, that was the permanent occupation of Saudi, of the Arabian Peninsula, which continues to this day. You know, all those borders were drawn by the British. They don't mean a thing to the people who are from there. That was it. That is what made Osama bin Laden the enemy of the United States. And although America really helped his Mujahideen movement, and he helped America in the Balkans in the mid and late 90s, Al-Qaeda fighters used as shock troops against the Serbs during the Kosovo War, for example. But basically, from 1993 on, Osama bin Laden explained over and over and over and over again why he was declaring war on the United States and any American or Jew anywhere in the world, according to his fatwa, because, of course, Osama bin Laden, much like an American Republican is a collectivist and doesn't differentiate between legitimate military targets and collateral damage, civilian casualties. It's all the same to him. But, you know, God says it's okay. So it's not too much different, really, than the Republicans here in America. You understand? Just to give you a little frame of reference there. Osama bin Laden is basically the, you know, the Wolverines or whatever of the Middle East. Doesn't make them the good guys. It doesn't make them heroes. As I just said, the guy's a collectivist. He's willing to kill innocent people. That's the definition of evil. But, of course, it's not Al-Qaeda, the stateless band of pirates, that has a world empire. It's America that has a world empire. And they are the resistance. Not that the manner of Osama's resistance is legitimate, but the fact that he's resisting certainly is. But so that's why there's an enemy in the Al-Qaeda movement. Now, it's also about manipulating oil prices and propping up dictators and backing the Israelis over the Palestinians and all those other issues. But primarily, it's the presence of American combat forces in Saudi Arabia. And no, not a single axis of evil state supplied a single 9/11 hijacker. They were all from countries that are friendly to our country, which is a euphemism for it, from countries whose governments are puppet dictatorships of the United States. Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and I forget, there's one other nationality in there somewhere. But anyway, even the ones where they were from countries where they're not directly occupied, if you live in Yemen and you listen to Osama, you don't see that line between Yemen and Saudi Arabia. The British drew that. The Arabian Peninsula is the Arabian Peninsula to them. And it's the holy land of Mecca and Medina, and it's not okay to have foreign combat forces there. And they all take that extremely seriously, and that's why America was attacked on September 11th, and that's who did it. It wasn't Iraq, it wasn't Syria, it wasn't Iran. It was people from countries that are our friends. And of course you hear people say, well, we should have invaded Saudi Arabia. No, we shouldn't have invaded Saudi Arabia. We should have got our troops out of Saudi Arabia. Anyway, I'm sorry. Here I am. I spent almost half an hour on this. 41% think Saddam Hussein did 9/11. Well, why else would we have gone into his country and murdered 600,000 people and destroyed what was once the land that was once called Iraq? Put 4 million people out of their homes. Condemned people to drink filthy water and die of heat stroke in the summer sun with no electricity. Why else would we do that? Why else would America go into a country and completely destroy it and murder 650,000 people? They must have done September 11th, right? Because if they didn't, then why, that would mean that our government is just as or even more evil on the quantifiable scale of evilness and Osama bin Laden. I mean, after all, how do you measure the evil if not in numbers of human skulls? That's how you count, right? How evil George Bush is compared to how evil Osama bin Laden is. How many people have they killed? Particularly, how many civilians? And in fact, you know, assuming that so-called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, that responsibility for that can be pinned on Osama, it's probably a pretty even heat at this point. But that's how I measure evil, the number of skulls of the victims of the murders. Does it matter? Is it supposed to matter whether they're Americans or Iraqis? I look at Iraq and say, hey, there was never a suicide bombing, not one, in the entire history of Iraq until after America invaded and occupied that place. Not a single one. So, I don't know. Make of that what you want. I'm going to play y'all some music and come right back. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Scott Charles. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Thanks very much for being patient and listening through this wonderful Iron Maiden song. I had to run next door and get some coffee, man. About to fall asleep live on the air, dude. You don't want to do that in the middle of Rant and Raven, man. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, Scott, it's Robert again. Sorry to keep bugging you. I've just been listening, and I know you said it's not an employment opportunity, but I really like what you guys stand for, and I would like to contribute some of my services, volunteer time. I have over 10 years audio production editing experience, and I love the music style and what you guys are talking about. And
cool, man. Well, I'll tell you what you do, man. Go to KAOS959.com,
okay.
And there should be contact information right there on the front page.
All right. Excellent. Thanks, Scott.
All right. Cool. Take care, man.
All right.
Oh, there you go, man. Guy loves the show so much he wants to come work for Chaos Radio. Imagine that. Dude, your job would be like going next door to get more beer. That would pretty much be your job description if you had a job. I don't know who'd pay you to go next door and get more beer. You'd probably have to buy it all yourself. Yeah, anyway, anybody else wants to call the show, it's 646-6446, 512-646. 6446, and I gotta move on here, dude. I spent way too much time on almost half of Americans believing Saddam Hussein did 9/11, which is just not true. I think I'll skip to Glenn Greenwald now. He'll be on the show Wednesday to discuss his new book, A Tragic Legacy: How Good versus Evil Mentality Destroyed the Bush Presidency. And we got a link to his latest blog entry on Salon.com up right now at antiwar.com in the viewpoint section there. Everyone we fight in Iraq is now Al-Qaeda. Josh Marshall publishes an email from a reader who identifies what is one of the most astonishing instances of mindless pro-government reporting yet. It's a curious thing that over the past 10 to 12 days, the news from Iraq refers to the combatants there as Al-Qaeda fighters. When did that happen? Until a few days ago, the combatants in Iraq were insurgents, or they were referred to as Sunni or Shia fighters in the Iraq Civil War. Suddenly, without evidence, without proof, without any semblance of fact, the U.S. military command is referring to all of these combatants as Al-Qaeda. Welcome to the latest in Iraq propaganda. And then Greenwald writes that the Bush administration, and specifically its military commanders, decided to begin to use the term Al-Qaeda to designate, quote, anyone and everyone we fight against or kill in Iraq, is obvious. All of a sudden, every time one of the top military commanders describes our latest operations or quantifies how many we killed, the enemy is referred to almost exclusively now as Al-Qaeda. But what is even more notable is that the establishment press has followed right along just as enthusiastically. I don't think the New York Times has published a story about Iraq in the last 2 weeks without stating that we are killing Al-Qaeda fighters, capturing Al-Qaeda leaders, and every new operation is against Al-Qaeda. The Times, typically in the form of gullible and always government-trusting reporting of Michael R. Gordon, whose name Scott Horton can't say without the puking in his mouth a little bit, though not only makes his claim over and over as prominently as possible, often without the slightest questioning, qualification, or doubt. If your only news about Iraq came from the New York Times, you would think that the war in Iraq is now indistinguishable from the initial stages of the war in Afghanistan, that we were there fighting against the people who hijacked those planes and flew them into our buildings. Al-Qaeda. What's so amazing about this new rhetorical development, not only from our military, but also from our quote-unquote journalists, which I don't even think Michael R. Gordon deserves an ironic quotes journalist. I don't even think you can call him that sarcastically. It's too far off. Is that for years it was too shameless and false even for the Bush administration to use, even at the height of their propaganda offensives about the war. The furthest Bush officials were willing to go was to use the generic term terrorists for everyone we are fighting in Iraq, as in we cannot surrender to the terrorists by withdrawing and we must stay on the offensive against terrorists. But after his 2004 re-election was secure, even the president acknowledged that Al-Qaeda was the smallest component of the enemies we are fighting in Iraq. This is a Bush quote now. A clear strategy begins with a clear understanding of the enemy we face. The enemy in Iraq is a combination of rejectionists, that is those who don't like being occupied by a foreign power. Saddamists, that is Baathists, and terrorists. The rejectionists, this is Bush talking still, the rejectionists are by far the largest group. These are ordinary Iraqis, mostly Sunni Arabs, who missed the privileged status they had under the regime of Saddam Hussein, and they reject an Iraq in which they're no longer the dominant group. I'm sure it's not really part of the problem that the new dominant group is the Iranian parties backed by America, but anyway, that's kind of besides the point, right? The second group that makes up the enemy Iraq is smaller but more determined, Bush continued. It contains former regime loyalists who held positions of power under Saddam Hussein, people who still harbor dreams of returning to power. These hardcore Saddamists are trying to foment anti-democratic sentiment against the larger Sunni community. The third group is the smallest, says George W. Bush, accurately, but the most lethal, the terrorists affiliated with or inspired by Al-Qaeda. And then Greenwald writes, and note that even for the smallest group among those we are fighting in Iraq, the president described them not as Al-Qaeda, but those affiliated with or inspired by Al-Qaeda, claiming that our enemy in Iraq was comprised primarily or largely of Al-Qaeda was too patently false even for the president to invoke in defense of his war. But now, support for the war is at an all-time low, and war supporters are truly desperate to find a way to stay in Iraq. So the administration has thrown any remnants of rhetorical caution to the wind, overtly calling everyone we are fighting Al-Qaeda. This strategy was first unveiled by Joe Lieberman when he went on Meet the Press in January and claimed that the U.S. was attacked on 9/11 by, quote, the same enemy that we're fighting in Iraq today. Though Lieberman was widely mocked at the time for his incomparable willingness to spew even the most patent falsehoods to justify the occupation, our intrepid political press corps now dutifully follows right along. Here is the first paragraph from today's New York Times article on our latest offensive, based exclusively on the claims of our military commanders. Quote, the operational commander of troops battling to drive fighters with Al-Qaeda from Bakuba said Friday that 80% of the top Qaeda leaders in the city fled before the American-led offensive began earlier this week. He compared their flight with the escape of Al-Qaeda leaders from Fallujah ahead of an American offensive that recaptured that city in 2001. Oh, did it now. The article then uses the term Qaeda, whatever, an additional 19 times to describe the enemy we are fighting. Qaeda leaders, Qaeda strongholds, Qaeda fighters, Qaeda groups, the Qaeda threat, etc. What is our objective in Iraq? To, quote, move into neighborhoods cleared of Qaeda fighters and hold them. In virtually every article from the Times now, anyone we fight is automatically designated Al-Qaeda. June 21, Michael R. Gordon. And Alyssa Rubin, American troops discovered a medical aid station for insurgents, another sign that the Al-Qaeda fighters had prepared for an intense fight. In a statement, the American military said it had killed 41 Qaeda operatives. June 20th, Michael R. Gordon. The problem of collaring the Qaeda fighters is challenging in several respects. The presence of so many civilians on an urban battlefield affords operatives from Al-Qaeda another possible means to elude their American pursuers. Since the battle for Western Bakuba began, Qaeda insurgents have carried out a delaying action, employing snipers and engaging American troops in several firefights. June 19th, Michael Gordon again. June 17th, Tom Shanker and Michael Gordon. And then here's one from the Washington Post. And I'm sorry, I'm not going to read you all these, but you're catching on, you get the point. From the Washington Post today, the battle came, and I think this is from yesterday, actually. The battle came Friday to the town of Khalis, about 10 miles northwest of Bakuba. U.S. forces saw a group of Al-Qaeda and Iraq gunmen attempting to avoid Iraqi police patrols and infiltrate Khalis from the southwest, according to a U.S. military statement. With those deaths, at least 68 suspected Al-Qaeda operatives have been killed in the offensive, according to the U.S. military's tally. And here is the headline from CNN's article yesterday. U.S. reports 68 Al-Qaeda militants killed in Iraq. Note that in the subheadline, CNN totals the number of militants killed as 68, which in the headline magically becomes 68 Al-Qaeda militants. That's because in our media, everyone we kill in Iraq and everyone who fights against our occupation are now all Al-Qaeda. Man. All right, skipping down further down the page a little bit here. Making matters much worse, this tactic was exposed long, long ago. Now, you're telling me. From the Christian Science Monitor in September 2005. The U.S. and Iraqi governments have vastly overstayed the number of foreign fighters in Iraq, and most of them don't come from Saudi Arabia, according to a new report from the Washington-based Center for Strategic International Studies. According to a piece in The Guardian, this means the U.S. and Iraq feed the myth that foreign fighters are the backbone of the insurgency. While the foreign fighters may stoke the insurgency flames, they make up only about 4 to 10% of the estimated 30,000 insurgents. And in January this year, the Cato Institute published a detailed analysis by Ted Galen Carpenter, who's probably the best guy at Cato these days, the myth of an Al-Qaeda takeover of Iraq. And you know, Robert Pape wrote one of these for the American Conservative magazine, What Happens If We Leave. And God damn it, I've covered this on this show, how many days are there in a year? I've covered this show 100 times on this show if I've covered it once, and I know I've covered it at least once. So it must be closer to 100 times. I've written about this. I wrote a blog entry 2 years ago or so, something like that, on antiwar.com called From Spain to Indonesia about Bush's hollow threats that Al-Qaeda, if we left, would take over Iraq and then create this giant Islamic caliphate and rule the world and all this crap. Every time I enter, well, not every time, but dozens and dozens and dozens of times when I've interviewed former military guys, former intelligence officials, some of the best reporters in the world, nobody believes that Al-Qaeda could take over the Al-Anbar province or any other part of Iraq if we left. Everyone knows that the foreign jihadist pilgrim fighters who've come to Iraq to get practice killing Americans are the tiniest percentage of the insurgency. That they've never been, according to generals on the ground over and over again who've admitted, there have never been more than 2%. And yes, they're destructive beyond their means, people who are willing to blow themselves up, drive trucks into crowds and blow themselves up. Somebody wrote Bush a good speech there or whatever, where he said they're the very smallest group. And, you know, here's the thing, too, about the New York Times. In the New York Times, supposed to be, the liberal New York Times who hates George Bush so much and hates the war so much. Hell, there's a editorial, op-ed piece, linked on LouRockwell.com today by Frank Rich, the editor of the New York Times, where, for crying out loud, he sounds like me through most of the article. Just calling out our government on what liars and murderers they are. It's the liars, especially. And all this murdering, they never tell the truth to justify the murder. I guess because the truth wouldn't justify it. Anyway, this guy Frank Rich writes this thing that sounds as anti-war as what you hear on this show. And he's the editor of the paper. And yet, somehow, Michael Gordon still has his job. Somehow, Michael Gordon, who does nothing but lie, and does nothing but repeat government lies as though they're true and as though he has somehow independently verified them, still has a job. Michael R. Gordon's piece of crap articles still appear in the New York Times. It never stops. You know, a guy like Michael Gordon, you know, who knows? Maybe he's a CIA agent pretending to be a journalist. That's possible. Google Operation Mockingbird. It's happened in the past. I saw a car like that, actually, the other day. I'm driving down the road of the car. Somebody had written in shoe polish on the back of their car. Google Operation Mockingbird. Yeah, good idea. Do that. So I don't know if Michael Gordon is CIA or if he's just the crappiest reporter in the whole world, and that's why he has a job at the New York Times, because they are the agenda setters. They feature all the news that's fit to print. They tell the rest of the media what's the important story. And so whoever's in charge up there at the New York Times has decided that they're going to let this, well, less than qualified reporter They're going to let him be in charge of all the stories about Iran's nuclear program, all the stories about Iran supposedly sending sophisticated do-wackies to the insurgency, Al-Qaeda, in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Maybe that's just the deal. The worse you are at reporting facts, the more secure your job is at the New York Times. As long as your bias is in favor of state power every time. How else do you explain it? You know, what really bothers me is, and I don't live in New York, I don't know about these things, but it must be, right, that Michael Gordon has to go out to dinner, doesn't he? Don't people spit in his face? Don't all the rest of his, the reporters in town, don't they hiss and boo at him? And, like, doesn't he feel everybody staring at him in the restaurant, scorning him for being such a liar, for being such a lousy reporter? How does Michael R. Gordon go home during vacation and look his family in the eye? Yeah, I made good. Yeah, my job is to tell whatever lie the government wants in the New York Times so they can justify murdering people. Does Michael R. Gordon not have a mom and dad? Does he not have to explain to them that that's what his job is? What about his children? Does Michael R. Gordon have children? How are they going to respect their father when they grow up? If they read his articles in the New York Times and see that all of his articles are full of nothing but an anonymous U.S. government source told me, and full of nothing but lies to justify more violence. Yeah, sure, Michael Gordon. Every guy who's shooting at Americans in Iraq is Al-Qaeda, huh? What a shame, you know? I think that's got to be the solution here, right? To single these journalists out and to shame them. Not like anybody's listening to this. Not like I can write a New York Times op-ed about what a shameful pretend journalist Michael R. Gordon is. I think they'd publish that. Michael R. Gordon, Worst Journalist in the World by Scott Horton. Boy, it wouldn't be difficult to just Google a couple of things here and there and put an article like that together. Yeah, maybe somebody out there will beat me to it. All right, this is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and there's so much to talk about, but I guess I ought to... shit, man. I can't decide. I can't decide. I guess I'll go to counterpunch.org and check out More Muscular Interventionism, The Foreign Policy of Barack Obama by Jeff Taylor. Thanks to Lou Rockwell for the link from the lourockwell.com blog. Barack Obama provides no alternative to Hillary Clinton in terms of imperial-minded foreign policy. This is doubly regrettable since Clinton herself provides no substantive alternative to the neoconservative philosophy of the Bush administration. As with Clinton and other respectable contenders for the Democratic presidential nomination, Senator Obama has consistently voted to fund the war and has opposed an immediate withdrawal of American troops. While state legislator Obama opposed an immediate war with Iraq in 2002-2003, he did not do so on anti-imperial or non-interventionist grounds. He opposed the war at a time when the idea was relatively unpopular, especially among his Chicago constituents. He later backpedaled somewhat from his public opposition, referring to the U.S. Senate authorization vote of 2002 and senators having access to intelligence reports. In July 2004, he told the New York Times, "What would I have done? I don't know." Asked about the pro-war votes of Kerry and Edwards, Obama told NPR, "I don't consider that to have been an easy decision, and certainly I wasn't in the position to actually cast a vote on it. I think that there is room for disagreement in that initial decision." Not exactly a stunning statement of the peace position. In July 2003, Obama argued that a unilateral approach to Iraq was not the best one, that a multilateral coalition against Saddam Hussein would have been better so that, quote, if we ultimately had to overthrow him, we would have built an international coalition that could have moved forward. An adept politician, Obama began emphasizing his anti-war, in ironic quotes, stance as the war became increasingly unpopular among Democrats across the country, and he began gearing up for the 2008 presidential campaign. Gone was the 2004 equivocating. He had found an issue with which to distinguish himself from Clinton, Edwards, and Biden. Campaigning among grassroots Democrats, Obama sounded like Cindy Sheehan, but his real, far more nuanced views have been laid out for members of the elite Chicago Council on Global Affairs. So I've never heard of that. Is it? He doesn't mean the Chicago branch of the Council on Foreign Relations? I don't know. In November 2006, he telegraphed his safe imperial mindset to the powers that be when he said, quote, there's one other place where our mistakes in Iraq have cost us dearly, and that is the loss of our government's credibility with the American people. Oh, no. Continuing the Obama quote here, according to a Pew survey, 42% of Americans now agree with the statement that the U.S. should, quote, mind its own business internationally and let other countries get along the best they can on their own. We cannot afford to be a country of isolationists right now. 9/11 showed us that try as we might to ignore the rest of the world, our enemies will no longer ignore us. And so we need to maintain a strong foreign policy, relentless in pursuing our enemies and hopeful in promoting our values around the world. Oh my God. End quote. Of course, Obama is being dishonest when he pretends that the U.S. government was trying to ignore the rest of the world prior to 9/11. Isolationism did not provoke the terrorists. On the contrary, the terrorist attack was partly a result of decades of U.S. intervention overseas, precisely the kind of meddling that Obama euphemistically calls maintaining a strong foreign policy, pursuing our enemies, and promoting our values around the world. This was the point made by Congressman Ron Paul, Republican of Texas, a principled and consistent Iraq war opponent, and it is understood by millions of populist Democrats as well. When you stick your hand in a hornet's nest, you may get stung. Perhaps the action is worth the possible consequences, but don't pretend that the sticking of the hand into the hornet's nest had nothing to do with the stinging. The hornets didn't choose to sting someone minding his own business simply because they hate freedom. In a second speech in April 2007, Barack, the would-be mad bomber Obama, told the CCGA, quote, I reject the notion that the American moment has passed. I dismiss the cynics who say that this new century cannot be another, huh? What the hell's he talking about? I dismiss the cynics who say that this new century cannot be another when, in the words of President Franklin Roosevelt, we lead the world in battling immediate evils and promoting the ultimate good. I still believe that America is the last best hope of Earth. We just have to show the world why this is so. The president may occupy the White House, but for the last 6 years, the position of leader of the free world has remained open, and it's time to fill that role once more. End quote. Yes, writes Jeff Taylor, the dream of Pax Americana must continue only under better management. Management that is more savvy in handling international public opinion. With a straight face, Obama declared, quote, in today's globalized world, the security of the American people is inextricably linked to the security of all people. He continued, world opinion has turned against us. And after all the lives lost and billions of dollars spent, many Americans may find it tempting to turn inward and cede our claim of leadership in world affairs. I insist, however, that such an abandonment of our leadership is a mistake we must not make. We must lead the world by deed and example. End quote. In his speech to the internationalists, Obama endorsed the Persian Gulf War of 1991, a bloodletting that had nothing to do with U.S. national security and was opposed by populists as diverse as Jerry Brown, Ralph Nader, Ross Perot, Pat Buchanan, and Chuck Grassley. Quote, no president should ever hesitate to use force unilaterally, if necessary, to protect ourselves and our vital interests when we are attacked or imminently threatened. But when we use force in situations other than self-defense, that is, when we start aggressive wars, we should make every effort to garner the clear support and participation of others. The kind of burden sharing and support President George H.W. Bush mustered before he launched Operation Desert Storm. Barack Obama, may you fall down 10 flights of concrete stairs, you piece of trash. God. Sorry, that wasn't Jeff Taylor. That was my own little editorializing there. Notice that Obama has quietly slipped in an endorsement of preemptive war with his wording imminently threatened. And notice also the use of the power elite's favorite foreign policy weasel words, our vital interest. This is a catch-all phrase that really means the economic and imperial interests of the Fortune 500 and their political deputies. Not shying away from military imagery, Obama said, in order to advance our national security and our common security, we must call on the full arsenal of American power and ingenuity to constrain rogue nations. We must use effective diplomacy and muscular alliances. He evoked the names of beloved figures of the bipartisan foreign policy establishment: Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, Richard Lugar, George Marshall, and Harry Truman. Senator Obama ended his speech with stirring words worthy of a neoconservative. The American moment has not passed. The American moment is here, and like generations before us, we will seize that moment and begin the world anew. Revolutionary fervor a la Robespierre and Trotsky has not completely left the Democratic Party in favor of greener Republican pastures. And then I love that, I'm not going to read you the rest of this, but the rest of this is about how many neocons love Barack Obama. Robert Kagan, who co-wrote with Bill Kristol toward a neo-Reaganite foreign policy, promoting the idea of benevolent global hegemony back in 1996, the guy whose brother Frederick came up with this bogus surge in Iraq, he wrote a column in the Washington Post called Obama the Interventionist, praising him. David Brooks, the stupidest person to actually be a political pundit for a living, a man who has been wrong about every single thing he has said for the last decade straight, with no exceptions, loves Barack Obama. Thinks Barack Obama is great. Yeah, he's like Truman. Barack Obama, bloodthirsty warmonger. Barack Obama would be mass murderer of innocent life. Barack Obama, one of the 10 most dangerous people in America, just because he's that close to the presidency at this point. The guy's at least as dangerous as John McCain. Or take that the other way around, you know, whatever you like. Oh, Barack Obama. I love Barack Obama. I made a music video about how I have a romantic crush on Barack Obama. Oh, Barack Obama. Just don't tell me anything about you. Yeah, don't let me know anything about your voting record. And please, whatever you do, don't play me any speeches of you in front of the Council on Foreign Relations talking about how you agree with the neocons about who all ought to be killed. You only think we ought to try a little harder to bribe Russia and France to join us. Oh, Barack Obama, you're a rock star. Oh, Barack Obama, I heard, didn't bother reading about it, but I heard you're the anti-war candidate. Wow, Barack Obama, you're great. Didn't read anything about it, but I heard you're the anti-war guy. This is Chaos Radio in Austin, Texas.
You see that smear on my face, but I won't run from you. Well, that's right, these are all my friends, and now what are you?
gonna do? Go ahead, try to push us around and we'll beat you. Black and blue, oh, it'll take you any shit as best from the likes of you, yeah, you. Assimilation is your game where two can also play. For me on end, all bad lines drawn and it's you who's gonna pay. You think you're right, you think we're wrong, where time will surely tell. We'll never give in, we'll keep on fighting, gonna shove you back down your well Assimilation is your game, but the booze are surely for it a shame. Assimilation is your game, but the booze are surely for it a shame. Assimilation is your game, but the booze are surely for it a shame. Assimilation is your game, but the booze are surely for it a shame, I say. There's spit on my face, but I won't run from you. But that's right, these are all my friends. And now what are you gonna do? Go ahead, try to push us around and we'll beat you black and blue. Oh, it'll take any shit as best from the likes of you, yeah, you. Generation is your game where you can also play. From it on in, the bad lines drawn and it's you who's gonna pay. You think you're right, you think we're wrong, where time will surely tell. We'll never give in, we'll keep on fighting, gonna shove you back down your well Assimilation is your game, but the bruiser surely for the same. Assimilation is your game, but the bruiser surely for the same.
Exciting news, Nation. On Monday, country superstar Toby Keith was on the show performing a song from his new album, Big Dog Daddy. Well, the Billboard charts came out yesterday, and what's America's new number one album? Toby Keith's Big Dog Daddy! Yes! Toby, you're welcome. This album is the latest beneficiary of the Colbert Bump. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the concept, stop watching the show. At this point, you'll never catch up. The rest of you know that the Colbert Bump is the curious phenomenon whereby anyone who appears on this program gets a huge boost in popularity, causing them to win elections, receive major awards, even get laid. That is known as the Colbert Bump and Uglies. Consider Salman Rushdie. A few weeks ago, he stopped by to bemoan the death of literary criticism. Now, he's been knighted. Coincidence? Or is the simpler answer that the Queen of England watches my show? After all, women of a certain age cannot get enough of me. Another lucky recipient of the Colbert Bump, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee. Before he came on The Rapport, his presidential campaign was polling at 1%. After his appearance, he soared to 3%. That's a 300% increase after a 2.5-minute interview. If he keeps up that pace between now and the election, he'll be the first candidate ever to get elected with 88,128,000% of the vote. Of course, there are those who refuse to acknowledge the Colbert Bump. Well, last week, we put it to the test by inviting Ron Paul to be a guest on the show. Who is Ron Paul? I thought he was a transvestite entertainer. Viva Glam. Turns out he's a Republican candidate for president. Judge the power of the bump for yourself. That afternoon, before his appearance on my show, no one knew who Ron Paul was.
I do not know who Ron Paul is.
Something to do with politics?
Oh, Ron Paul's...
But that would soon change. Raise your hand If you'd like to abolish the IRS, FEMA, the UN.
Get rid of them all.
Well,
attack them.
Sir, thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with your candidacy. I hope you get the Colbert bump.
I'm prepared.
Sorry, but no one's prepared for the Colbert bump. Little did Ron know, as he left my studio, what awaited his post-Colbert candidacy.
I would like to see him dismantle the Federal Reserve and IRS.
Homeland Security.
Oh, yeah. We're the Cupidgee twins, and Ron Paul made us Republicans.
Oh! Hey, take us rally to Times Square!
Later that night at Times Square. In Germany. North Korea. Ancient Rome.
Ron Paul. 2%. You went from 0 to 2. Barack Obama, come on the rapport. It is the second most influential television show in politics, right behind reruns of Law and Order.
All right. Thank you, Stephen Colbert, for giving a little attention to Dr. Paul. I sure appreciate it. And yeah, you know, probably wouldn't be a bad idea to get Barack Obama on the show to explain his support for the doctrine of preemptive war. Why not? I'm trying to find my Obama clip on this playlist. Come on, Obama clip, where are you, man? I can't find you. Obama clip. Remember from the first debate? When he said, I'm not planning to nuke anybody right now. And Mike Gravel said, oh good, well then we're safe for a while. Damn, I can't find it. Anyway, yeah, Barack Obama. But yeah, Ron Paul, yeah, thanks Stephen Colbert for mentioning Ron Paul again. Appreciate that. That's an extra little, half a point bump there, probably. And, yeah, you know me, I'm a big Ron Paul fan, always have been, ever since he went back to Congress, and I guess 97 is when he took office, won the election in 96, and I've been a big fan of him for a long time. And for people who don't know him, he's the guy who wants to get Osama bin Laden, but that's it. He wants to bring our troops home from Europe, from Japan, from Korea, from the entire Middle East. He wants to get bin Laden, Zawahiri, and frankly, use the military if necessary, special forces types, if absolutely necessary, to kill Al-Qaeda. But mostly wants Al-Qaeda guys, people who are actually a threat to the United States, to be captured and tried with the Bill of Rights. And He wants to end the occupation of the world. He wants to close our 1,000 military bases around the world. Did you know America had 1,000 military bases around the world? Yeah, they don't usually talk about that all day and all night on TV and the radio. But it's true. And Ron Paul wants to close them all and bring those troops back here so they can sit on their ass and do nothing and be safe back at Fort Hood and Fort Bliss and Fort Bragg and the rest. So they can sit with their rifles on the shelf and do nothing in safety. That's called supporting the troops. He's also a consistent opponent of all expansions of federal police power long before 9/11 and obviously ever since opposed the Patriot Act, the Department of Homeland Security, the creation of the Transportation Security Administration, the new National Intelligence Director's Office, and the Military Commissions Act, the Defense Appropriations Act of 2006, the John Warner Defense Appropriations Bill that gives Bush the power to nationalize all the State Guard units without even asking and use them in other states and to do all these things at his whim. To basically put our country in a state of total martial law. Ron Paul's voted against all those things. And He's giving great speeches, unlike the rest of the congressmen who never read the bills and just vote the way the guy who made them wants them to vote. Ron Paul and his staff read every bill until they get to the first unconstitutional part, and then they put it down and vote no. And luckily for him, that's not much reading, because there's usually something unconstitutional on the very first page of these things. He's for free trade. Ron Paul's not an isolationist. He's for the globalization of capital and the globalization of private interests, of people, of artists, businessmen, you name it. He is for political independence, and that's not isolationism. Barack Obama. That's not isolationism. It's called independence, as in the Declaration of Independence. The advice of all the founders of this country, not that they ever really followed it very well themselves, but to stay out of foreign entanglements, to have free trade with all and entangling alliances with none, commerce with all, friendship with all, alliance with none shall be our motto, Thomas Jefferson, right? That's Ron Paul's position on trade. He's for free trade, but he's against NAFTA and the WTO and the North American Union and the Free Trade Area of the Americas and all the rest of that kind of stuff. Because that's not free trade. That's government. That's expanding the size and scope of government. Of course, to protect politically favored interests. And that's not okay. He wants to legalize drugs, at least on the federal level. He wants to completely end the drug war, stop prosecuting people in states who are obeying their state laws in regards to medical marijuana, but who are currently being prosecuted by the federal government anyway. He wants to put an end to that immediately. He wants to put an end to a foreign policy toward Latin America that is based on the so-called cocaine war, which is, should really be called the war to make cocaine more expensive, which is all it really is. And the guy, he's truly for federalism. He's truly for not just, well, first of all, he's for devolving the power of the presidency back to, well, the void where it came from and, you know, on an actual constitutional basis to the Congress that delegated authority to him that they did not have the authority to delegate. And you know what, damn it? I understand. If anybody was telling me, you know, I support this politician, here's why, I don't really have too much to hear about it. And if I were you and I didn't know who Ron Paul was, I would think, this is stupid. Why should I believe that any politician in the world is really, once he's the president, is really going to give his power away? Is really going to try to scale back the authority of the national government to massive degrees? And give those powers back to the states, back to the Congress, back to the people. Why should anyone believe that? Well, there's one way to judge that. And, you know, it's a prediction, right? It's the best you can do. But I say look at Ron Paul's voting record. And look at his consistency in favor of liberty and against Leviathan. You know, I really need to reread all about the details of this. It's been a long time. But basically, the Continental Congress offered George Washington total power at the end of the American Revolution. And he said, you've got to be kidding me. Here's my sword. I resign my commission. Thanks very much. If you need me to be your chief executive of your limited constitutional republic in 15 years or so, give me a call. Meanwhile, I'll be at home bossing my slaves around and screwing my wife. Bye. And he left. We all learned that as kids, and that one's true, right? That's not, oh, he refused to lie about chopping down the cherry tree. That's true. George Washington, at the end of the American Revolution, renounced power. He gave it away. And of all the various legacies of this country, criminal and otherwise, that is one of our greatest gifts. That piece of our history, that example set not just to future Americans, but to people of the world, that it is right and proper to renounce your authority, to give it away. And Ron Paul knows that story, and I believe very strongly. I do believe, I have faith, believe it or not, in a Republican politician that were he to be the president of the United States, that he would do everything he could to restore the Bill of Rights, to restore the checks and balances and the separations of power in this system, to restore the old republic. He means to do that. He really does. And, you know, whatever. I'm not really pushing for Ron Paul to be the president, because Lord knows you got to have Lockheed money to be the president. But I am, first of all, happy to see so many people learning about Ron Paul, reading his articles, watching his speeches, and understanding his point of view, learning about liberty. And then, you know, secondly, I want to encourage people who don't know about Ron Paul to look him up. And this isn't really about making him the president. Come on. Come on. I'd have to have I Dream of Jeannie and Bewitched powers both to make Ron Paul the president. That's not what this is about. It's about liberty. It's about teaching people about liberty. And you know, if the American people can get on board for that, hell, if 41% of the American people can believe that Saddam Hussein did 9/11, why can't we trick them all into believing the truth that our government's too powerful and we need an anti-government president? Shouldn't be too hard. This is Chaos Radio in Austin, Texas. My friends, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton. This is Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. And before I get to my guest real quick, I'm sorry, I have to announce a couple of corrections. Last week, I stupidly repeated what the Austin American Statesman claimed was a fact, which is just dumb on its face, and especially because they were doing nothing but citing the Austin Police Department, who, as we all know, are nothing but a bunch of liars and murderers. Well, in this case, four men beat a man to death for hitting a child shortly after the Juneteenth celebration. And I repeated the erroneous report from the Austin American Statesman that The man was beaten to death by a mob of Juneteenth celebrants. That is just not the case. It was four people at an apartment complex separate from the Juneteenth celebration, and it's all my fault for repeating what the Austin American Statesman repeated from what they heard from the Austin Police Department. And another correction real quick, because somebody just sent me an email, and I don't know where I got the idea Frank Rich was the editor, but he's just a columnist at the New York Times, and so therefore he can't fire Michael R. Gordon. Poor guy. None of us can fire Michael R. Gordon. It's so frustrating. Okay, so that's all my corrections. Thanks very much for your patience there. And now let me bring on Eric Margolis, one of the greatest foreign policy correspondents in the whole world. His website is ericmargolis.com. He's a contributing foreign editor for Sun National Media in Canada and for the American Conservative Magazine. He's the author of the book War at the Top of the World, and you can often find his articles rerun at lewrockwell.com and at antiwar.com. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Well, it's great to be back with you.
Yes, it's good to talk to you again. It's been a couple of years, I think.
That's right.
And now, I was a kid at the time, and so I don't really know, but I'm under the impression that you spent the Cold War paying very, very close attention to relations between the United States of America and the Soviet Union, and you're very schooled in these types of foreign policy matters. Is that right?
Well, indeed, I did pay very close attention, and I spent a great deal of time in the old Soviet Union, Moscow, and out in the other Soviet republics, and since one of my specialties is military affairs, I took particular focus on that area.
And now you've covered, what, 14 wars, is that right?
Yes, as a war correspondent, 14 wars.
My goodness. I don't guess anybody can see that much war and live through it unless they're a journalist, huh?
Well, I've certainly used up 12 of my 9 lives, I can tell you that. I'm showing high metal fatigue at this point.
Oh, what kind of fatigue now?
Metal fatigue.
Oh.
Well, body fatigue. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, 12 of your 9 lives. We'll count you lucky. We'll put you at the top of the list of lucky, I guess.
Thank you.
Okay, so we gotta get into this new Cold War. That's what everybody's calling. If you go to Google News right now and put in new Cold War, you'll get I don't know how many thousands and thousands of results. Everybody's saying that relations between America and Russia are falling apart. And, you know, gee whiz, I remember, I was a kid, but not too young, and I remember the fall of the wall, and a year and a half or so later, the final dissolution of the Soviet Union, and all the hope and promise that came with that. What the hell is going on that we're now in a situation that people are calling a new Cold War?
Well, that is an overreaction, and hyper response by the media. We're not going back to the Cold War, but what we are doing is going back to the traditional balance of power. Let me explain what I mean by that. In the Cold War, the ethos of the Soviet Union, of the communist system, was to destroy capitalism. And I remember Khrushchev saying those words, "We will bury you." And that's what the Soviets really had in mind. They didn't quite know how to do it, but they were determined on an ideological basis to destroy capitalism and its main proponent, the United States. Today, it's different. There is growing conflict and contention between Russia and the United States, but Russia, today's Russia, has no ideological ambitions or motivations to spread communism around the world or to overthrow capitalism. What this is about is Russia is going back to its traditional, call it even pre-communist, strategic interests in Eastern Europe and the Middle East and in South Asia, and is beginning to reassert itself after being on its knees ever since the Soviet Union collapsed until Putin came to power. Russia was a basket case. It was funded by American dollars, dominated by the U.S. government. Today, Russia is going back to being traditional Russia, and that's what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. And now, is there anything expansionist about that policy that they're taking back up?
Well, on a very high-level view, Russia is traditionally, geopolitically, an expansionist power. That's the nature of Russia. It tends to expand its power until it hits water. and water being the Baltic, the North Sea, the Mediterranean, or the Indian Ocean, the Pacific. That's Russia, just the way the United States expanded until it finally hit water and had to stop. The collapse of the Soviet Union in 91 tore apart the old Soviet empire, and now Putin and the men close to him, the KGB, which is really running Russia again, have decided that they want to reassert Russia's traditional geopolitical goals. I don't think it's going to be a violent campaign that's going to spark wars, but really Russia wants to reassert its influence and stop acting like a beggar and get off its knees and start acting like Russians, who are still a great power and a very important people.
How come this is a problem for America? It seems like with the end of the Cold War, we would be the ones who wanted to reach a handout to help them up and make them our best friends. I have to tell you, if you'd asked me in, I don't know, 1998 or something, I would have guaranteed to you that Russia would be a member of NATO by now and helping us fight our holy jihad against the brown people of South Asia.
Well, the Russians didn't want to be part of NATO, and it really it didn't make sense. But more important, you know, after the collapse of the Soviet system, Russia was really totally weak, was bankrupt. It was kept alive by secret American money that was laundered through Russian businessmen gangsters. The U.S. assumed enormous influence in Moscow, and they propped up the whole financial system. Russia let the U.S. do pretty well whatever we wanted around the world, gave us carte blanche in exchange, even sold to Washington. The crown jewels of Soviet military technology were sold, if you can believe that. They even allowed access into KGB files. So, but this was an anomalous period. When Putin came to power, and thanks to the war in Iraq, oil prices started going up. Russia suddenly started getting money. It started getting rich again. Didn't need U.S. cash to function. Kicked out the drunken Yeltsin. And the KGB, as I said, took power. So what we Washington got used to obedient leaders in Russia, just the way in the Middle East all the leaders it calls moderates. A moderate is a synonym for obedient. Mm-hmm. And the Russians, you know, yes, sir, no, sir, were three bags full, sir. When Putin came along, all of a sudden the obedience stopped, and Russia went back, as I said, to being acting like a normal great power. And the United States was shocked by this. It had become too spoiled over almost two decades of getting instant obedience from Russia. And so the official policy changed, and the tame U.S. media, which often acts as the megaphone for government policy these days, launched this jihad against Russia and all these cries about the Cold War and everything else.
Right. The new authoritarianism, Putin as Stalin and all that propaganda.
Well, Putin is an authoritarian. There's no doubt about it. What modest civil liberties and media press freedom there was in Russia has been ended. Only token opposition is allowed. But, you know...
Yeah, same here.
Well, yes, unfortunately. I've written many times that under the Bush administration that the U.S. has become Sovietized. There's an old Taoist expression saying you become what you hate. And in fact, I've written so often that our government and our media acts just like the Soviets did in the 1980s. It's very disturbing. But anyway, about 70% of Russians back Putin. He is the most popular leader they've had since Stalin. And he's not doing Stalinist things, and he's not a Stalin. But Russians want a firm leader, and they want things to get done rather than having democracy, which really affects only a tiny 1 or 2% of them.
Mm-hmm. And now, so what exactly is America's interest that's being frustrated here? I mean, you point out that it's Bush's war that's made them all so rich. That goes for Iran and Venezuela and everybody Bush wants to pick a fight with. He's putting them all on the top of the world by driving oil prices up so high.
Well, it's ironic, isn't it? And then he helped Iran by overthrowing its two worst enemies, Taliban and Iraq. So one could ask, you know, who is Bush benefiting? But no doubt these countries have all been enriched by the Iraq fiasco.
And now, but so how does this hurt America? I guess there's a pipeline deal where America built this pipeline that cuts the Russians out of the equation. Something.
Well, the U.S. has been trying to engineer numerous pipeline deals that prevent the Russians from benefiting from the pipelines. A, the U.S. wants to build one through Afghanistan. That's why our troops, the primary reason American troops remain in Afghanistan, is to assure the pipeline route from Central Asia, which will take the exports out of the sphere of Russian interest, also plans to put them under the pipelines under the Mediterranean. And this is equivalent to the 19th century's conflict over strategic railroads. The U.S. is doing pretty well so far in trying to block Soviet pipeline deals, but there's no doubt Russia is now exports a huge amount of oil, right up there with Saudi Arabia, and there's no way the U.S. can really contain Soviet petroleum power.
A little slip of the tongue there, huh? The Soviet petroleum power.
Oh, I'm sorry. I miss the good old days. I'm an old Cold Warrior. I miss the good old days.
Well, I find myself saying Saddam when I mean Osama sometimes. They just get right into our brain with that stuff.
You and the American public.
Yeah. I was just covering that poll this morning. 41% think Saddam did it.
Well, you know, that's way down because I'm writing a new book called American Raj. And I cite the figure that in 2003... 79% of Americans, queried by the Washington Post, believed that Saddam Hussein had launched the 9/11 attacks. And that was thanks to the untruths that were pumped out by the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm. And now, let's rewind a little bit. I'm sorry if I'm kind of out of joint here, but let's talk about the 1990s a little bit more. You have this former communist state where, you know, the empire controls everything, basically, and then it falls apart. And I guess my understanding is that these oligarchs basically came in and former KGB guys mostly, is that right, came in and basically cornered the market and bought up all the real resources and then just looted them. And then I guess my understanding is that Yeltsin let everybody get away with that for all those years through the 1990s, and then
That
ended with the palace coup d'etat of New Year's Eve 1999, right?
That is correct. You know, when I was in Moscow in the 1980s covering it, I was the first Western journalist who was ever allowed into KGB headquarters at the Lubyanka prison. And I talked to two senior KGB generals, and they told me, and other KGB officers who I got to know well, that the KGB had become completely disgusted with the Communist Party. It was rotten. It was falling apart. It was going to take down Russia. They said, we don't want to go down the drain with the Communists. The KGB decided to cut its links with the Communist Party, and its mission was to protect the Communist Party and to strike out on its own. And it had all the smartest and brightest young men in the Soviet Union.
And when did they tell you that?
In the late 1980s.
Ah.
And they said, I remember one general telling me, he said, you know, what we need here in Russia is we need a General Pinochet, referring to Chile's military leader, or to a Park Chung-hee, who was the Korean military dictator who took Korea, a bank poor, dirt poor agricultural country, and turned it into an industrial giant. We need to make lazy Russians work at gunpoint, was what he told me. And they got one. They got Mr. Putin, a former KGB director, who is a very capable man.
Mm-hmm. And then I remember, actually, on the night before Y2K, and they said, they just announced Putin has resigned. And I remember Clinton praising the transfer of power and saying, well, we're glad it was a constitutional transfer of power there. Like, wait a minute. A few months before the election, you put in the guy who's already the front runner as to replace you? That doesn't quite sound like a constitutional transfer of power.
Well, it didn't. And the Clinton administration had a lot of unseemly dealings in Russia, as I said, including money laundering and funding the Yeltsin government and allowing through American banking support that a lot of these shady transactions involving tens of billions of dollars go on.
Uh-huh. All right, now let me ask you about all these dead journalists. People are saying, you mentioned that you know, dissent is barely allowed in Russia at all, and there have been journalists who've been killed, and the accusations, of course, are always that Putin's behind it. What do you make of these?
Well, the fact is certainly true. The journalists have been killed all along. We've just only noticed this recently with the death of the crusading journalist Anna Politkovskaya, in fact, who I interviewed twice. And but it's been going on. Speaking out in Russia is very dangerous. And we don't know who's doing it. My best guess is that it's, you know, members of the old KGB, which have moved into the modern, the current security service, the FSB, the KGB replacement, or this sort of demi-monde, as they say in French, this sort of half-world of where crime and government sort of meets. And you have in Russia these companies that are quasi-gangsters, quasi-former intelligence men. They're also, one of these groups is suspected of having murdered the Russian FSB director, Alexander Litvinenko. But these are these groups, and they are sort of semi-legalized criminals, privateers, buccaneers, whatever you want to call them. They operate in the shadows, and much of business and banking in Russia uses these people for enforcement, for collection and protection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I talked with Larissa Alexandrovna from The Raw Story, and she told me that if you look at, well, for example, the death of Litvinenko and the seeming opposite sides of Putin and his group on one side and Berezovsky and these other criminals on another side, that really this is all just one big network of former KGB gangsters that you really can't differentiate. Maybe there's faction fights within here and there, but basically all we're talking about is, well, like you say, basically where gangsterism and government come together.
That's right. That's right. Well, where the ex-intelligence or current intelligence agents make use of these this netherworld of gangsters, semi-official gangsters, to do their dirty work, what the KGB used to call wet affairs.
Mm-hmm. And now, I don't know if you know much about this subject, but I had an interview last week with Dr. Gordon Prather about the Nunn-Lugar-Domenici bill and the attempt that was made by actual reasonable people in the American Senate to secure excess fissile material from the Soviet Union when it fell apart, that basically when they took apart their offensive weapons that they moved out of Europe, pulled out of Europe and moved back into Russia, that they took those offensive weapons apart, and that so they had all these fissile cores laying around everywhere, and the Americans were trying to buy them up. Seems to me like, you know, the best policy would have been to offer to buy every nuke that the Russians had, you know, leave them a dozen or something to keep us out. But other than that, you know, there are people all over the world now who say that the biggest danger really is that somebody's going to buy a former Russian nuclear bomb, a former Soviet nuclear bomb on a black market somewhere, and it's going to end up going off in North America or something.
Well, this has been a fear, you're right, for a long time. And the late Russian general Alexander Lebed, who was a presidential candidate, one of the more upstanding figures in the Soviet political arena, said in an interview that before he was murdered, that there were 100 suitcase bombs, nuclear weapons, missing, unaccounted for. There certainly is a lot of Soviet fissile material missing. And the U.S. was right to be very deeply concerned about this, and this was before 9/11. Most of the pressure then came from friends of Israel in Congress, who were worried that the Arabs might somehow get hold of a nuclear weapon to use against Israel. Now there's worry, of course, as you say, it might be used against the U.S. But let me tell you, I had to go for a medical test where I was injected with a tiny amount of radioactive thorium or some kind of a radioactive isotope, which they use for X-ray imaging, mm-hmm. and or medical imaging. And 3 days later, I was going down to New York from Toronto, and lights went off at U.S. immigration, and sirens went off, and armed guards came running. And, you know, I had to get doctors' statements saying that I'd been injected with a tiny thing, you know, of radiation 3 days later. So I'm in America, we are looking for radioactive threats for sure. It doesn't mean one couldn't be smuggled across the border. It's not that easy. They have to be shielded, they're heavy, and everybody's looking.
Right. And, well, I guess a couple of things here. One, I'm glad to know the radiation detectors work. Sounds like they're up.
They work very
a little
well.
Too sensitive. But also, you know, Gordon Prather says there's no such thing as a suitcase nuke. He says the closest thing you could get to a suitcase nuke would be, like, say, the trunk of a Lincoln Town Car nuke.
Well, no, I don't agree with him. I have seen pictures, at least, of the Soviet nuclear devices, and they are in a large suitcase, metal suitcase.
Really?
It's a big suitcase, and it's a heavy one. It's not your overnight bag, but it is in a very small area.
Wow. And do you know whether what kind of bombs those are, hydrogen bombs? Or?
I don't.
Yeah. Wow, interesting.
I would suspect they're probably an atomic weapon. The U.S. had similar weapons, nuclear demolition charges, which were also quite small and which were used, could be used to block mountain passes or blow up bridges, a man-portable weapon.
Mm-hmm. In fact, well, it's been years since I've read about this, but I'm sure you probably know all about it one way or another. Reports that during the Cold War that Soviet agents had stashed weapons, not necessarily nuclear weapons, but had stashed weapons all around the United States of America in case of an eventual war. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I've read reports about that over the years, but and it's wonderful stuff of spy novels.
Mm-hmm.
But to my knowledge, there has never been... None of these weapons have been uncovered. Ironically, the U.S. and its allies and NATO were doing exactly that. They had a secret program called Gladio.
Uh-huh. Stay behind.
And the Stay Behind Forces, and under which large amounts of caches of arms and explosives were buried all over Western Europe. Some of them fell into the hands of terrorist organizations. But I can tell you one thing. In Edmonton, outside north of Edmonton in Alberta, in the 1950s, a Ukrainian immigrant came from Russia, settled in Canada, had been sent by KGB as a deep penetration mole. He was a bomb was made available to him in a trunk, and he had kept it in his basement. And his orders from KGB were when he got a coded phone message. That he was to take this bomb, put it in his pickup truck, and drive it to the main oil pumping station north of Edmonton and blow it up. He turned himself into the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. This is an absolute a fact, and it's the sole example I know of potential sabotage. And he had been waiting, by the way, for over 25 years when he turned himself in, or 20 years. So if there was this one guy, there must be others.
Wow. And now, that wasn't an atomic weapon.
No, it was just a conventional explosive, right. Which was designed for sabotage.
That's funny. I like that. 25 years later, he goes ahead and turns himself in. The New Onion has a headline, which is Al-Qaeda sleeper cell can't get off its lazy ass. I'm just waiting till the season finale of Grey's Anatomy or whatever, but then I'm going to go carry out my terrorist attack. Shows a picture of a big fat terrorist sitting on the couch eating a bag of potato chips.
Well, even terrorists get lazy. There could be something to it, or discouraged, or suddenly they may not just be in the mood to face death on that particular day.
Right, yeah. Yeah, life in America really ain't that bad. And, you know, The Onion, of course, is the satire newspaper there. That was a joke, yeah. Okay, so let's talk about NATO expansion. The former Warsaw Pact nations between Germany and Russia, how many of them have now been brought into NATO?
Well, the entire Warsaw Pact, that starts with Czechoslovakia and Hungary being the two probably most important members. Poland, very important. Romania, Bulgaria, five, plus the Baltic states, which were not independent at the time. Some have I forgotten anybody? I hope not. But those are the five big European states that were in the Warsaw Pact. And everybody wondered in those days, in the 80s and the 70s, if the balloon went up and a war became NATO and the Warsaw Pact went to war, whether these guys would fight on the side of the Soviets or immediately turn their guns on the Soviets and defect over to NATO. We didn't know. But now NATO has moved right up to Russia's western borders.
Mm-hmm. And what's the point of that? Just to threaten them?
First of all, the nations involved believe, as I believe, that Russia's post-communist collapse weakness was temporary and that one day the Russians would be back full force, the Russian bear would be out there, and that the Russians would again start exerting their influence into Eastern Europe. And the Eastern European states were scared, and with good reason. They were desperate to shelter behind NATO's shield. So for them, this was a great thing, particularly the Baltic states, too.
Right.
And, but primarily Poland and Hungary, who had suffered so much from the Soviets. So they were anxious, and the U.S. just couldn't say no. I personally think it was a major mistake. I think a demilitarized zone should have been created through Middle Europe and Eastern Europe, and I think some of the states in Eastern Europe who are coming into NATO or even the European Union have no business being there, or certainly unready to be members. But nevertheless, it was done rashly, I think. And I say rashly because NATO suddenly assumed the defense of territory which it could not, or at least had not, the capability of defending. And it was a major provocation to the Russians, who are, you know, historically and famously very sensitive about their borders, and were already thought that they were being surrounded and isolated by U.S. power.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there must be a big level of corruption involved, too, in terms of, like, basically, every country that joins NATO gets a giant delivery of American planes and so forth.
Well, arms deals figure prominently in this equation because it meant that all these new members of NATO would go out and buy American equipment.
Mm-hmm. With American taxpayer dollars.
Yeah, in part. And not only equipment, but training programs and industrial equipment and cars and the whole kit and caboodle. But I come back to the point again that militarily, being in the Baltic states or in Romania and Bulgaria really don't give any military advantage to NATO. They're a liability because NATO, while having acquired these territories, has not put military bases in them and has not increased its armed forces and made supply depots in these areas ready to defend these areas in the event of a war. So it's really, in effect, created a liability for itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I'm not sure if that's good news or bad news. I guess we shouldn't be taking on responsibilities that we can't live up to, but that's, I guess, in a way, it's good that we're not putting bases in there and stuff. But that's a responsibility I don't want to live up to.
Well, it's good and it's bad. You're quite right.
Yeah. Now, so we got to get to this missile defense thing. George Bush claims that he wants to put defensive missiles in Eastern Europe to protect from Iran.
Well, this White House comes out with some of the most remarkable and weirdest theories and statements. Of course, this comes from the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq crowd who formulated these bizarre ideas. And the latest thing, this idea about Iranian missiles, first of all, Iran has no nuclear weapons. Second, Iran has no missiles to carry them. It has some short-range missiles that go a couple hundred miles. It has one missile that we may go up to 1,500 miles, and that's it. And Iran has no way of threatening the United States any more than Iraq did. But this huge hue and cry has gone up, and evangelical Christian preachers are beating their pulpits, warning about the threat from Iran, and you hear all kinds of nonsense from it. And the Bush administration has now roiled and hurt relations with Russia by advancing this cockamamie plan to put anti-ballistic missile radars in Poland or the Czech Republic and anti-missiles designed to shoot down the Iranian missiles that don't exist.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you bring up this crazy brand of Christianity led by Pastor John Hagee and others like him. Part of their whole narrative is Iran and Russia versus Israel, right?
That's correct. It all fits their loopy view of, end of days and Armageddon and the world's about to be destroyed. It's a dangerous cult, and it is a cult that forms a core electoral group for the Republican Party, unfortunately. I say this as a Republican. and it has enormous influence on U.S. foreign policy. Now, people who believe this and are forcing this kind of policy, and, you know, we've got to have greater Israel so that the biblical prophecy can come to be, and the world can be destroyed, these people are as extreme as some of the followers of Osama bin Laden. I think it's very scary.
Yeah, you know, Bill Moyer said that a major change in his lifetime is the delusional is no longer marginal. Before, it was, you know, realists of different opinions arguing about the proper balance of power, what have you, what have you. But now we have people who live in a total fantasy world where the Earth is only a couple of few thousand years old, and we must have a nuclear war with Russia and Iran in order to force Jesus to come back. And these people, as you say, make up a substantial core of the support of the Republican Party in this country now.
There may be 40 million U.S. citizens who believe these kind of grotesque fantasies, and it is scary. And one of the reasons that there's a lot of anti-Americanism abroad, particularly in Europe, is that Europeans are very alarmed by seeing the mighty United States being dominated or guided, certainly heavily influenced, by people whom the Europeans, who are very unreligious, regard as religious fanatics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and it makes good sense. I mean, we're talking about a $3 trillion a year empire here. That's a lot of power to be in the hands of some kooks. I mean, at least Dick Cheney, as psychopathic as he might be, or at least, you know, as willing to murder innocent people as he might be, seems to basically be tied to the actual reality that exists on Earth. You know, even though his opinions on it are often quite skewed, he's still, I guess, you know, a safer bet than people who think that you have to start a nuclear war to get Jesus to come back faster.
Well, it's a pretty scary choice between between one or the other. But we have these groups are unhooked from reality. They have drifted off somewhere. And the problem is that so many Americans, particularly in the heartland of the U.S., are completely isolated from the outside world. And, you know, a large portion of these evangelical Christians get all their news on the outside world from Christian TV.
Mm-hmm.
Pat Robertson, that kind of rubbish that's put out. And it is very frightening. But the Republican Party, unfortunately, has been taken over by these people and by a southern bloc of, you know, deeply fundamentalist religious people. And that's one of the reasons that we're in the mess we are now abroad, and one of the reasons the Republicans are going to be thrashed in the next elections.
It almost feels like we've adopted Israel's foreign policy that, well, rather than, say, following your advice and saying, hey, let's demilitarize Eastern Europe and make sure we don't have this problem in the future, that we're basically taking the Israeli strategy that if we just lord it over everybody all the time and just, you know, hover our giant jackboot over their head, that they'll cower and not oppose us, which of course doesn't work. It only makes matters worse for everybody.
Well, it is now impossible to tell whether Israel, who's making the policy, whether it's made in Washington or Jerusalem, but there's no doubt that the combination of pro-Israel neoconservatives who engineered the Iraq war, and the Christian fundamentalists, Christian Zionists as they're called, a Jerry Falwell, Hagee group of people, who are fulminating for greater Israel so that Jesus can come back, have dominated, have taken over American foreign policy in the Middle East. And I think you can see that they see the results from one end of it to the other. It is the worst mess I've ever seen in the last 50 years, and it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah, I mean, we don't even have time to get into what's going on in Gaza and Lebanon. The whole damn region's falling apart right now. And yet, and we're taking the same policy, basically, to the Russians, to the guys who have, what, still 20 or 30,000 nuclear weapons? And you know, I heard an analogy about the missile defense, where they said, you know, hey, a missile defense system, assuming that it worked and it was anything but a welfare program for people who are already billionaires, I mean, assuming it was even plausible, sounds like a good enough idea to have a missile defense system. What's wrong with that? Except that what it represents to the Russians is a nuclear-armed bully who's now wearing armor. And so it's not just a defensive thing. It's and I think this is what Putin said in his press conference a couple of weeks back, that this missile defense, supposedly, whatever you want to call it, this welfare for billionaires, is inextricably linked as part of America's nuclear policy all the way around. It's not separate from the offensive weapons, really. What it amounts to is, you know, you and me were a fair fight, but now I'm wearing armor.
Well, anti-missile systems, you're quite right, are in effect an offensive system because they allow an attack to be made knowing that you can ride out the inevitable counterattack that will come. They are, you know, I remind that General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, who I consider the greatest American modern president, warned about the military-industrial complex's growing influence, and that was back in the 1950s, and he advocated worldwide nuclear disarmament, something that was never carried through, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And now something that you, I think you bring this up in your most recent article that was run on LouRockwell.com, it was about pushing our rivals, I won't call them enemies because they're not my enemies, but pushing our country's rivals together, basically healing the Sino-Soviet split by the way of, you know, pushing them together to oppose us. And it seems like, in fact, I talked with Chalmers Johnson, who talked about, hell, you can go ahead and count Berlin and Paris in with that Moscow-Beijing axis, too. We're pushing in the name of preventing any near-peer competitors growing up against us in the world. We're pushing all the people who could possibly oppose us together into a power block.
Well, this is a truism of international relations. When one power gets too strong, other powers will amass against us. This happened in Europe, for example, under Napoleon. It happened with Hitler, the same thing. And not comparing us to Hitler, but I'm saying that when power gets too strong, others will coalesce against us. And we've done it. We missed, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, in my view, Washington missed a great opportunity to really lay the foundations for better international cooperation. And instead it adopted this hegemonistic policy that was, and the author of which, by the way, was Paul Wolfowitz, the disgraced head of the former of the World Bank, who was one of the engineers of the Iraq War. And Wolfowitz, back right after the collapse of the Soviet Union, wrote these very important memos saying that, you know, we must dominate the whole world militarily and economically, and no power must ever again be allowed to challenge the United States. I mean, this is the neocon power plan. And the result is, I mean, it's typical bloody-minded, stupid university professors who don't know anything about the real world. And, in fact, what happened is that it resulted in this outpouring of anti-Americanism around the world.
Yeah, it absolutely has. And, you know, the polls that I've looked at, there was one that came out, I guess, just a month or two ago, where populations all over the world, even, well, you know, my dad did a lot of business in Asia when I was a kid and talked about how the hard feelings from the World War and from the Korean and Vietnam Wars, they were basically healing over, if not all the way healed over, that, you know, in most of those countries, especially like Japan, they're Buddhists, you know, they don't want to hold a grudge for three generations or something, and that a lot of that anti-American sentiment left over from World War II and the Cold War was basically healing over, and yet now we've completely destroyed that too. Iraq isn't anywhere near Asia, and yet, well, you know what I mean, East Asia. The average Joe there is looking at what's going on in Iraq and saying, oh my God, these people are insane.
Well, I travel around the world constantly, and I must say that in my entire life, and I'm in my 60s now, in my entire life, I have never seen such virulent anti-Americanism all over the world. It's burning. It's incandescent. It horrifies me. You know, when American travelers start wearing little Canadian maple leaf pins to pretend that they're not Americans, it is ghastly. All the polls, the Pew Research Organization has done some excellent polling in this area, and the results are just horrifying. I mean, that Mr. Osama bin Laden is far more popular than George Bush is a telling indictment, and that most people in the Muslim countries feel now in recent polls that America is determined to destroy Islam, which is not the case, but that is the image that has been projected. And we are generating more enemies than we can possibly ever deal with. The good news is that, well, that's the bad news. The good news is that a lot of the hatred against the United States is actually focused on the persona of George Bush and his government, Cheney. And perhaps when they are gone from office, some anti-American feelings will begin to subside.
Well, let's hope that's true, although looking at the likely candidates to replace him, I'm not too confident. But, you know, you bring up a very important point that I think used to be maybe the founding premise of the conservative philosophy, which was that actions have consequences. Imagine that, actions having consequences. You can't just do what you want without engendering hatred.
Well, I'm an old-style conservative Republican, and an Eisenhower Republican, let me call it that. And, you know, I believe that, as President Eisenhower and our founding fathers said, that we have no business going mucking around in other parts of the world. Once in a blue moon, as in case of World War II, you may have to do it. And we did a brilliant job of rebuilding Japan and Western Europe afterwards and withdrew with honor and glory. But aside from that, this constant involvement around the world, you know, our troops are now operating in sub-Saharan Africa and in Somalia. We've got over 110 military bases around the world. This is the kind of interventionism that is not consonant with conservative principles. It calls for keeping a low profile and staying out of many of the world's problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially, you know, when you look at Russia and China, here are two rising powers. I mean, Russia has nowhere to go but up, basically, from where they are. China is this incredible new rising power on Earth. And yet somehow our policymakers want to take the approach of pointing our finger in their chest and picking on them and pissing them off. It makes no sense at all. When we could have, as you say, the founding fathers' foreign policy, friends and trade with all, a tangling alliances with none.
Well said. You know, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist. I'm not. But the military-industrial complex, there are certain. We know what everything we used to accuse the Soviets of was true, and everything the Soviets used to accuse us of was true too. There are warmongering circles in the Pentagon in Washington. We now call them neoconservatives. Who want a confrontation with China. They want to do it to beef up the U.S. military and sell more arms, but they really think that the military response and containment of China is the proper foreign policy solution, and that one day we'll have to fight China, and we might as well do it sooner than later, etc. It's a daft policy. The United States can never win a war against China except for a nuclear war. And it misreads China's intentions completely. I spent a lot of time in China over the last few years. And it is provoking, as you say, is provoking the Chinese unnecessarily. It's a dangerous and ill-considered policy.
Yeah. Well, I'll have to have you back on the show sometime real soon to tell me all about China. I'm very interested in what you have to say about that.
I will look forward to it.
But we are all out of time now. Everybody, Eric Margolis, he's a contributing foreign editor for Sun National Media in Canada. And for the American Conservative Magazine, his book is War at the Top of the World. You can look up everything he writes at ericmargolis.com. Thank you so much for your time today, sir.
My pleasure.
Shit! There's an army of 200 million marching down the river Euphrates, coming toward the Persian Gulf. There's going to be the meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion that is unplanned for. on the charts of all of the dictators of the earth. It's not an invasion from the north or the south or the east or the west. It's an invasion from heaven. And he will establish his kingdom, and of his kingdom there shall be no end. I am telling you, that makes this message one of the most thrilling prophetic messages you've ever heard in your life. You could get raptured out of this building before I get through finished preaching. We are that close. John the Revelator says in Revelation the 19th, and I, John, saw the heavens open, and he that sat upon a white horse was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness doth he judge and make war. And out of his mouth shall go a two-edged sword, with which he shall smite the nations of the earth.
America, fuck yeah. Coming again to save the motherfucking day, yeah, America, fuck yeah. Freedom is the only way, yeah. Terrorist, your game's through, 'cause now you have to answer to me. America, fuck yeah, America.